Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the NSA wiretapping story again, this time in Espanol. Also, economic uncertainty is back, or maybe it never went away. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 28th of October. Good as always to have you with us. We've got a little bit more information about the National Security Agency's overseas doings this weekend. Turns out it wasn't only the French and the Germans whose phones the NSA has been tapping. It seems 60 million or so Spaniards had their calls hoovered up as well. Tom Burridge is the BBC's man in Madrid. Tom, it's good to speak with you.
You too, Kai.
Spaniards opened their copy of El País a couple of days ago. They see that they, too, have been spied on. Is it all the hubbub on the streets, or are they taking it in stride?
Well, I mean, you know, our snapshot of opinion on the streets of Madrid today, yes, people don't like it. You know, they don't like the idea of the American intelligence agencies allegedly looking into their phone calls, emails, etc. How worried is the Spanish government? You know, generally speaking, in the past, they've been very supportive of the US on foreign affairs. I think, you know, publicly, they've obviously changed their language. They've come out much more strongly today. And that's obviously a partly response to public opinion here. People won't like the allegations, and it's getting more traction in the Spanish media. I think the Spanish government's also under pressure from their European partners. France and Germany have come out stronger over the last few days, forming this kind of common front, if you like, against America over this row over spying. And therefore, I think Spain knows that it has to fall in line to a certain extent with France and Germany.
Do you think Prime Minister Rajoy is going to meet with German Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande of France and have a little tete-a-tete and then you know, bring something to the state saying you got to cut it out, or we're really going to get serious?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've got to remember with this is, you know, who is Spain's most important ally now? Is it the US or is it Germany? And I think, you know, probably you'll argue the latter. You know, the Eurozone crisis, increasing integration on an economic front between Spain and its Eurozone partners. And I think, you know, Spain has to be more sensitive to what Germany wants on this. And I think, you know, there will be this European front. They probably will meet up, and they probably will want some kind of common response from the United States, from Washington. Whether they'll get exactly what they want, that remains to be seen.
I don't know how much Spaniards ordinarily frequent, say, McDonald's or Starbucks, but might they stop going?
They go there quite a lot. Yeah, all the Starbucks and McDonald's near me are pretty full. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think there's any kind of anti-US feeling on this yet. Maybe that will change, but so far, no problem. I think Starbucks and McDonald's are safe.
Is there any kind of acknowledgement over there that everybody reads everybody else's mail and this is just kind of the cost of doing business in the 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, a lot of people we spoke to on the street weren't surprised that this is happening. We spoke to a former Spanish ambassador to the United Nations, and he said, look, you know, if Spain, Britain, France could actually do this, if they had the capability of America in terms of intelligence gathering, we'd do it, was his opinion. And, you know, he wasn't surprised by this, didn't really feel that this was anything that people should be shocked by. But I think there will be some implications for public opinion here in Spain. People on the street don't like the idea of America listening into phone calls or maybe monitoring emails.
Tom Burridge for the BBC in Madrid. Tom, thanks very much.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
On Wall Street today, a split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of numbers out today that didn't do the economic mood any favors. A report on pending home sales, that is, properties on which contracts have been signed, were down more than 5% last month, the biggest drop they've had in 3 years. Also, production at American factories rose, but just barely, 0.1%, well below what the experts had been guessing. There is a bunch of reasons for both, of course. Here's a big one. It starts with the letter UN and ends with certainty. Jim Burris takes a look.
We are in the midst of an economic recovery. We are in the midst of an economic recovery, aren't we? That hesitation is uncertainty, and consumers and companies alike have experienced a hefty dose of late. Think back to late September, when all the talk was government shutdown. Ellen Haberle is an economist with real estate company Redfin. She says Uncle Sam wasn't a big factor.
The slowdown in September was mostly related to changing market conditions and less related to the government shutdown.
Rising mortgage rates and cost-conscious buyers played a bigger part.
I do think, however, we will see the impact of the government shutdown in October numbers.
So in September, the housing market was just on another irrational swing. October's numbers could reflect an irrational Congress. It's a similar story for manufacturing.
It's hard to say from one month to the next exactly how this is playing out.
Don Sabrese is an economist at Kennesaw State. He says, yeah, the shutdown had maybe a little something to do with slower industrial growth, but so did uncertainty over the healthcare law.
There's still a lot hanging over the heads of the manufacturing sector and the economy itself.
Today, we got part of the before shutdown picture. Next month's numbers, yeah, don't expect them to be great. November's figures, no one's certain. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Speaking of uncertainty as we are, we come now to the Affordable Care Act. Calls for delay are growing louder. A handful of Senate Democrats have now joined Republicans in asking the White House to hold off on the individual mandate. That's part of the law that fines people for not getting insurance. Watching all of this extremely closely, insurance companies, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Imagine that we're flies on the wall of an insurance company boardroom. Between the technical nightmare that is healthcare.gov and the louder and louder calls for a delay in the individual mandate, we'd likely see a whole lot of red-faced execs.
They're probably a little mad, a little annoyed.
Bradley Herring is a professor of health economics at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Well, first off, they've been beaten up pretty badly over the past, 3-4 years. So if there was a bad guy in the play that was enacting healthcare reform, I mean, they were certainly it.
And now, with healthcare reform nearly here, the ground could shift again. The insurance companies set their premiums based on one set of rules about everyone having to sign up. But if those rules change and people don't have to get health insurance right away,
then they're kind of left holding the bag.
Robert Leshefsky heads the healthcare consulting firm Health Policy and Strategy Associates. He says if the individual mandate gets delayed,
it would be a disaster.
Sick people will sign up, but the healthy folks,
the vast majority of them are going to sit it out. And Obamacare is going to implode, quite frankly, because the financials just won't work.
He says a delay would be uncomfortable for the big insurers, but they'd manage because the new exchanges will make up a small part of their business. The nonprofit insurance co-ops set up for the exchanges to increase competition will have a much harder time making the math work. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
One more thing before we go on. Penn State has agreed to pay $59.7 million to 26 victims of former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. That's in exchange for an end to their claims against the university. Of course, the money will be paid by insurance policies. A year ago this week, Hurricane Sandy took out big chunks of coastal New Jersey and Long Island. The rebuilding is still going on, but in some of the towns that were hit, there is a twist. A lot of those homes were second homes, vacation places, that weren't fully insured. And that is causing big problems for local officials. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports from Ortley Beach. It's a couple hours drive south of Manhattan on the Jersey Shore.
Johnny Fry's is one of the few places open for lunch here. It's packed with contractors, construction workers, and city workers.
Best burgers in town.
It's a reflection of what's going on outside. The town is desperately trying to rebuild. It's pretty slow going.
A year later, it still looks like Beirut at high noon in three quarters of the neighborhoods in Ortley.
Louise Pesci lives in the next town over and drives through pretty often.
You know, houses are still broken down on their sides, or no house at all, and just a pile of mortar and sticks, and that's it.
The town has done a lot. It's replaced its boardwalk, it's brought in new sand for the beach, the Army Corps of Engineers is going to build protective dunes, there's a different detour every day as all the main roads are getting rebuilt, but there's one big problem.
As you can see here, there are now hundreds of homes that have just been abandoned. They were second homes. They don't have any insurance.
Tom Kelleher is the mayor of Toms River, which includes Ordley Beach. He says the damage to city property alone was $36 million, but for homes, it was much worse. He's driving through town, passing one vacant home after another. Out of 2,000 homes here, he estimates about 70% are second homes. And of them, hundreds still look like they did right after the storm.
People who live there full time are now beginning to call us and say, look at this house next door. It's all overgrown. I see mice and stuff running under the deck. The town has done everything we can do, but we can't go on private property and rebuild homes for people. That's an individual's responsibility.
Kelleher wants people to move back and make his community what it once was, but so far, these homeowners haven't done that. He says if they don't deal with their property, the city's going to have to. It'll start taking houses down.
We're going to have to serve them with a violation notice. Eventually, that would permit us to say, okay, it's a violation, you didn't fix it, so we're going to demolish it and put a lien on a property.
Right now, I'm in front of a small, one-level, white house. There's a bunch of daisies growing in the front, a bit with quite a few weeds. And on the front door is an orange sticker. It says, unsafe structure notice. This building is declared unsafe for human occupancy. Clearly nobody is home. I caught up with the owner of that bungalow here in Manhattan.
When I go down the shore, my wife and I, we get very depressed. I mean, we spent every summer for the last 10 years down there with our grandchildren and with our kids.
Fausto Dorado is 69, retired, used to work at a body shop. He says right now he just can't afford to do anything with his vacation home in Ortley.
I got flood insurance and I have wind insurance. The wind insurance said they blame the flood insurance. The flood insurance, they blame the wind insurance. Meanwhile, I'm not getting anything.
If he continues to get nothing, the city will knock down his home and he'll get stuck with the demolition bill if he ever tries to sell the land. He says some of his neighbors didn't even have flood insurance. They couldn't afford it and lived far enough back they figured they didn't need it.
These are not McMansions in Ortley Beach.
Tony Tomorazzo is another Ortley homeowner.
They're small, sometimes, cottage-like homes that people have saved a lifetime to be able to invest in.
Her beach house was destroyed during the storm. She lives in Hoboken.
Second homeowners were not able to take advantage of almost none of the aid packages from FEMA or the state.
But that's not going to change anytime soon. And Mayor Kelleher says the municipality can't wait forever.
We don't want to start signing complaints against people who are in a bind or stepping on somebody when they're down. But it's getting to the point now where now we're going to have to take steps to fix it.
In this beach town, even 1 year later, Sandy is still not done wiping out homes. In Ortley Beach, New Jersey, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My sister didn't do her homework, so I had to do her homework with her, and then I had to do my own homework, do my chores, and didn't get any sleep that night and had to do it the next day.
The work-life balance of low-income teens. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's kind of a meh day, actually, on Wall Street. That's meh day. The Dow Industrials was off 1 point, basically flat, closed at 15,568. The NASDAQ off 3 points, about a 10%, finished at 3940. The S&P 500 picked up 2 points, more than a 10%, ended things at 1762. Drugmaker Merck beat earnings expectations despite rising competition from generic drugs, but the company lowered its profit forecast for the full year, and shares thus tumbled 2.5%. Today, Merck competitor Pfizer added 0.4%. Reports quarterly profits tomorrow. JCPenney again told investors that sales trends are improving, and investors again like the news. The department store shares rang up more than 8% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose just a tad, 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. Data starved? Here's your fix. The Commerce Department reports on September retail sales. The Labor Department issues its monthly producer price index, also for September. And the Conference Board releases its consumer confidence index for October. And it's National Oatmeal Day. Can oatmeal save us from Halloween candy? I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Apple reported quarterly profits after the bell this afternoon. They made about $1 gazillion. No, that's not true. $37.5 billion total revenue, to be precise. But it is what you call a perfect segue to this. A new study out today that confirms what parents and grandparents already know. The under 8 set is a tech-savvy bunch. Not only are more kids using technology these days, they are starting younger. According to the group Common Sense Media, 38% of kids under the age of 2 have used a mobile device like an iPhone or a tablet computer. And that, I believe, is what you call a business opportunity. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Talk about fine motor skills. Johann's Joseph's son had the iPad finger swipe down before he was a year old.
He knew the difference between Apple and Android. He knew Android, he needed assistance to get it turned on, and Apple, he did not.
Joseph, who works for a financial firm in New York, limits his now almost 2-year-old to 90 minutes of screen time a day, mostly puzzles and alphabet games. He and his wife are like many parents, often glued to their own devices, letting their kids play too. Jim Steyer is CEO of Common Sense Media.
Today, as many little babies and 1-year-olds have used smartphones or tablets as all kids under the age of 8 had done nearly 2 years ago. That's a phenomenal increase.
Media companies have noticed. Disney just announced its new show for preschoolers, Sheriff Callie's Wild West, will debut on an app and only later come to TV. Disney's own research found that more than half of households with children now have tablets.
The way families are using media, Disney can reach kids where they are, not just where the television set is.
That's David Kleeman, a senior fellow with the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media. Yes, that Mr. Rogers. All that reach hasn't been lost on the American Academy of Pediatrics. Today it reaffirmed its recommendation that kids under 2 stay away from screens. There's probably an app for that. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We do our share of statistics and numbers and the like on this broadcast. It kind of comes with the territory. But every now and then we figure it's good to break through a little bit, talk to people who live and work out in the actual economy. Austin Golding helps run his family business. It's called Golding Barge Lines out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. We call him up from time to time just to check in, see how things are going. Mr. Golding, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
We had you on back in March right after the drought. Business was getting better. How are things now?
Well, things are still rolling in our industry. I think a lot of the domestic crude production that we've been hauling on our barges has really helped prop our market up through the summer and going into next year.
Yeah, I guess it's that whole domestic oil production thing, right? I mean, we got natural gas, we got oil, we got the whole smash.
We really do. I think people, when they hear about the domestic oil production in this country, don't hear the positive side of it enough. It's putting a lot of people to work, and a lot of companies are growing and really benefiting from it, including us.
How is it that that you guys benefit so much? I mean, are you guys that much cheaper than loading up an 18-wheeler with you know, however many thousands of gallons of oil it is?
I think so. You look at taking 1,300 trucks into one barge. That's about the equivalent, about the ratio
Wow.
we provide. Then we push two or three of those at a time. And, you know, while we can't get it to individual small discharge ports, we can take it to a very large refinery. So the volume that we can provide definitely puts us way ahead of everybody else.
Where are you in the business cycle? Are you hiring, firing, expanding? What are you doing?
We are extremely, extremely fortunate right now to be going in the midst of a major expansion. You know, our business employs right now between 130, 150
Wow.
people. And by this time, 2015, we'll probably be close to 250 people.
Give me a sense of how many, I don't even know what it is, barges or push boats or whatever. How much gear on the river does 150 people translate into?
Well, you know, right now we operate anywhere between 14 and 16 tow boats. generally pushing 2 to 3 barges apiece.
Was the government shutdown a problem for you guys? Did you see anything happening because of that?
Our industry did see a little bit of a slowdown during it. We had a lot of momentum going, and I don't know if it was just purely coincidence or if there's a direct relation, but there was a slight slowdown or at least stall within our marketplace during the shutdown.
You know, we're talking elsewhere in the broadcast today about this idea of uncertainty in the economy, and we talk about it a lot, frankly, just out and about, right? How businesses and consumers hate uncertainty. Is it a problem for you if people don't know what government policy is going to be, whether shutdown is going to happen? I mean, people got to ship oil, I guess, right?
They do. I think the consumption of it directly ties to our demand, though. And if people are unsure and they start to be more fiscally conservative or not as aggressive with their business plans or day-to-day lives, it's going to trickle down to how efficiently and how much we operate. During the recession, people found ways to be more frugal with their cash, and it definitely comes down the line as far as mass transit and mass product displacement.
Austin Golding from Golding Barge Lines down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Mr. Golding, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
The challenge of finding the right balance between work and family is nothing new. It's been a big social issue for decades now. Working moms and working dads as well, to some degree, trying to find a way to make everything work. Now, you throw in young people, teenagers, especially low-income kids who often have a whole load of extra responsibilities at home. Youth Radio's Joshua Clayton reports on the balance a lot of young people have to find between home, work, and school.
For working-class families, there is no safety net. When elderly relatives get sick or kids need to be looked after, their responsibility often falls to young adults.
My name is Jonathan Anabo, and I'm 20 years old.
Jonathan Anabo helps care for his 10-year-old sister, Katrina.
Yeah, he makes breakfast.
Including some of the best toast in Alameda, California. Their dad died a year ago, and their mom leaves for work early. So Monday through Friday, Anabo fills in as the parent.
He drives me to school. He picks me up from school. Like, he supports me into what I do, but not being like a potato couch.
Preventing his little sister from becoming a couch potato requires sacrifices. Instead of taking a full-time job, Anabo works just 3 days a week. He only takes college classes if they finish in time for him to pick up his sister. And once, he even brought his sister to work with him.
I could have left her here, but I don't like leaving her home alone. I mean, what parent wants to leave their kid home alone? Who doesn't want to give him attention?
Across the bay in San Francisco, 18-year-old Alexandria Ferre takes care of her 3 siblings. But she can't bring them to her job. She works at the baseball stadium, AT&T Park.
Yeah. Is that the ice cream or is that something else?
It's the ice cream flavor.
Teenagers work the cash register during a Giants home game. They're with a nonprofit called Juma Ventures, which helps young people with school and gives them a job. Ferre is one of their success stories. And she knows all about work-family balance.
It's really difficult because you're in this awkward stage of trying to figure out who you are. And also, you know, you're trying to be the adult. You're trying to support all these different people.
Ferre was raised by a single mother. She took the job to help with rent and food and was like a part-time parent, especially to her 12-year-old sister. A typical day starts at 8 a.m. for Ferre, then to work, then home by midnight, where sometimes there are problems waiting. Like this one time.
My sister didn't do her homework, so I had to do her homework with her, and then I had to do my own homework, do my chores, and didn't get any sleep that night and had to do it the next day.
She has one goal, be the first in her family to graduate from a 4-year college with no loans. Siobhan Riley knows that challenge. She's an economics professor at Mills College.
If they have major caregiving responsibilities and they have earning responsibilities, they don't have a fair shot at investing in their education.
Riley says many of her brightest and most organized students struggle to graduate. They're just too busy with job and family commitments. So how are people my age supposed to get this balance right? Choosing between investing in ourselves or taking care of loved ones? Riley says the answer could lie in a sailing proverb.
One hand for the ship and one hand for yourself.
Meaning that if you don't look out for yourself, you can't look out for your family in the long term. Jonathan Anabo has been manning the ship for quite some time. Does he want it to end?
I mean, do I hate this life? I think I've grown to appreciate it. Like, at first, I wasn't all for it. I was kind of thinking for myself.
For now, he's putting his family first. And Anabo says it'll be worth it in the end. In Oakland, I'm Joshua Clayton for Marketplace.
Joshua's story is part of our Jobstacles series from Youth Radio's New Options Desk.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which is a little bit marketing, a little bit genius, and a little bit, frankly, of a godsend. Twitter and Starbucks launched a new partnership today. It is called, and I kid you not, Tweet a Coffee, a $5 digital gift to the recipient of your choice. You sync up your Starbucks account and your Twitter account. Use the handle @TweetACoffee and then the handle of the desired recipient, and you're basically there. Remember, I'm at... Oh, wait. Never mind. That wouldn't be cool, would it? No. All right. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off a single point, a tiny fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ shed 3 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, more than a 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Lana Anwar. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.